you resolve for the sake of the Lord's name to be welcoming and merciful to the poor, strangers, and to all those who are in need. Today the church celebrates the memorial of St. John of God, the founder of the Brothers Hospitallers, otherwise known as the Frate Beni Fratelli, beautiful name, the Brothers Who Do Good. And his memorial warrants changing the sequence of the resolutions bishops-elect profess, taking the seventh of the nine, which concerns charity, starting with it this morning. St. John of God was born in Portugal in 1495. At 27, he became a soldier in Castile. Like can happen in the military still today, while in service, he gave himself over to vice, became licentious, and lost the practice of the faith. Eventually, the army was disbanded and he worked as a shepherd. But at the age of 40, stung with remorse for his past sins, he resolved that he wanted to be healed and give himself over in some way to God's service. He tried first as a martyr among the Christian slaves in Morocco, but like St. Anthony of Lisbon, he failed. People thought he was just too crazy to kill. Returning home, he began to care for the poor and the sick. Eventually, he went to a sermon by St. John of Avila and was so affected that he began to fill the church with his cry, beating his breast and imploring God's mercy. St. John of Avila, declared a doctor of the church in 2012, gave him God's mercy and set him straight. From that point forward until he would die at 55, he immersed himself in God's mercy and sought to pay it forward. He founded a hospital and allowed himself to be surrounded by those who would eventually become the Brothers Hospitallers. Before, it was his private charity, but then because of his concern for how many actually needed ministration, he unselfishly allowed assistance, and they eventually became these Frate Beni Fratelli. In a letter he wrote that the church presents to us this morning in the Office of Reading, St. John of God describes this connection between having received God's mercy and sharing it, and how in sharing it, we open ourselves up to receive it more. For a heart open in love is open to receive God's mercy. Pope Francis, by the way, on that point, says that the heart has systolic and diastolic functions. It's got to be pumping out mercy if it's ever going to be able to receive it. And if the ventricles or the atria are dead, the person's dead. It's a two-way street. St. John of God makes the same point. If we look forward to receiving God's mercy, we can never fail to do good, so long as we have the strength. For if we share with the poor out of love for God, whatever He has given to us, we shall receive according to His promise 100-fold in eternal happiness. What a fine profit. What a blessed reward. Who would not entrust his possessions to the best of merchants, who handles our affairs so well? With outstretched arms, he begs us to turn toward him, to weep for our sin, and to become servants of love for ourselves and for our neighbors. Just as water extinguishes a fire, so love wipes away sin. His life shows us how he advanced in the Lord's own mercy, until it overflowed in such a way that his contemporaries simply called him St. John of God. John of God. There's something particularly beautiful about that genitive predicate. People recognized God in him, that he was a gift from God, that he lived off of God, that in a sense, as Francis came from Assisi, as Catherine came from Siena, and the other John came from Avila, his origin was in a sense the heart of God who was love. People saw in him what they would say and see in St. John Vianney 3 centuries later. Dieu dans un homme, God in a man. And what a pleasing thing it would be if in life and death we might be so perfused by the charity of God that we would be known as Alexander of God, Thomas of God, Robert of God, Joseph of God, Peter of God, Jaime de Dios, Roger of God. He's so transfixed. Okay. That's not just a pious thought. It's noteworthy that this resolution is the only one that states, for the sake of the Lord's name. The church grasps that there's a connection between the way we are welcoming and merciful to the poor, strangers, and all those in need, and the hallowing of God's name. Jesus said at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, "So let your light shine before all, so that seeing your good deeds, they may glorify your Father in heaven." Ubi caritas, Deus ibi est. Our charity reveals something about the God who not only inspires it, but makes it possible by giving Himself and all we have at our disposal to us so that we might share in His providential care. One of my spiritual fathers is Cardinal Sean O'Malley, who as Bishop of Fall River ordained me, and whom I had the privilege to share many late night pizzas and gelatos. He told me that when he got the shocking news that Pope John Paul II was transferring him from St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands to Fall River in 1992 to help the diocese address and heal from the James Porter sexual abuse scandals, the first call he made was to St. Mother Teresa, begging her to send missionaries of charity with him to the diocese, because he knew that the church in Fall River would have a difficult time recovering unless the true face of the church, which is love, could be shown. And Mother responded. The Holy Father, Pope Francis, has captured the attention even of those who are suspicious of the church and religious institutions in general because of his palpably generous concern and prioritization for those who are outcasts, for the marginalized, for the poor, like the multitudes living in the Vias Miserias outside Buenos Aires, for prisoners, for immigrants and refugees, for the homeless. For me, the iconic image of his papacy, which I've got framed and keep in my office as a reminder of the charity to which I'm called, was his embrace of Vinicio Riva in November 2013. Vinicio might be the most repulsive figure I have ever seen. From the Italian town of Vicenza, 53 when he met the Pope, Vinicio has neurofibromatotic tumors, these ugly, stinking, bleeding growths all over his face, his hands, his body, his feet. I think looking, you'd rather see a leper. And because of that, both the stench, the potential bleeding if you even touch him, not to mention the sight, he suffered a lifetime of hurt and misunderstanding. His aunt Caterina Lotto was trying to bring him to the Vatican and for an audience with the Holy Father. But a couple of the first attempts she made when he was on the bus, everybody vacated because they just didn't want to be around somebody who looked like that. Eventually she was able to get enough people to grasp that he wasn't contagious in his state. There's another type of neurofibromatotic tumor that is, so that they would come with him down to an audience with the Holy Father. Because he can't walk because of the tumors on his feet, which would bleed like crazy and cause so much pain, they had arranged for a wheelchair. The aunt didn't really know that if you really want to get to the front lines at St. Peter's, just arrive in a wheelchair. So the Swiss guard just kept waving him forward and forward all the way up to where the front row was. At the end of the audience, Pope Francis came down, as he routinely does, to greet those who are handicapped. He went straight to Vinicio first. His aunt Caterina said in an interview, when he came close to us, I thought he would give me his hand. Instead, he went straight to Vinicio and embraced him tightly. I thought he wouldn't give him back to me. He held him so tightly. We didn't speak. We said nothing. But he looked at me as if he was digging deep inside, a beautiful look that I would never have expected. Vinicio said in an interview with Panorama, he didn't have any fear of my illness, which was shocking. I'm not contagious, but the Pope didn't know that. He just did it, period. He caressed my whole face. And while he was doing it, I felt only love. It lasted a little longer than a minute, but it felt as if it were eternity. I was quivering. I felt great warmth. And he said that the encounter brought about a great change in him. I feel stronger and happier. I feel I can move ahead because he showed me that the Lord is protecting me. I see every day at the United Nations the consequences of the churches having a reputation for charity like this, assisted by the example of Pope Francis. In an age that in some ways has gone beyond even relativism, which doubts epistemologically that anything can be known to be true or absolute, to one that seeks positively to create and define reality any way one wants. Something we see in Justice Kennedy's 1992 Casey decision, that at the heart of liberty is to define one's own conception of the universe. Or in the ever-growing list of possible genders that one can declare to be changed as easily as changing cell phone covers. Many are suspicious of any limitations at all. Many view the truth not as something to set them free, but as something to restrict their freedom for self-recreation. And for that reason, especially among the young formed by these ideas, leading with the truth can often hinder rather than help the new evangelization. Leading with charity is different. The witness of charity, especially when it involves true commitment and sacrifice for those whom an occasionally cold world recognizes has no right to it, can lead people from caritas to caritas in veritate, and then to veritas, and finally to veritas incarnata. The Church's charity is what gives the greatest glory to God's name. It's the most effective and important beginning of the new evangelization. And the lack of charity among those in the church will always remain the greatest scandal. I've always been very moved by the image of the bishop in Victor Hugo's Les Misérables. The character of Bishop Charles-François Bienvenu Myriel, called Monseigneur Bienvenu, Monsignor Welcome in the novel, is based on the real-life Bishop of Digne, Bishop Bienvenu de Mioli. While a little-known priest, he had a chance encounter with Napoleon and praised him. As a result of which, because of the way bishops were made in France at the time, Napoleon made him a bishop. But he continued to act like a common, compassionate country priest, welcoming everyone. He moved into the small town hospital so that the episcopal residence could be used as a hospital to care for the sick. He kept only a tenth of his salary for himself, spending the 90% on alms. He once accompanied a condemned man to the scaffold after his pastor refused. Hugo's narrator summarizes the bishop's philosophy, which is based on this real Bishop Mioli. There are men who toil at extracting gold. He toiled at the extraction of mercy. Universal misery was his mine. The sadness that reigned everywhere was but an excuse for his unfailing kindness. Love each other. He declared this to be complete, desiring nothing further. And that was the whole of his doctrine. One night, as we see in the novel, Jean Valjean shows up at his door, asking a place to stay the night. Bienvenu graciously accepts him, feeds him, and gives him a bed. Valjean takes most of Bienvenu's silver and runs off in the night. The police capture Valjean and take him back to face Bienvenu. When the police inform Bienvenu that they found his silver with the diocesan coat of arms in Valjean's knapsack, Bienvenu tells the police that he had given them to Valjean as a gift. He then chastised Valjean in front of the police for not taking the silver candlesticks as well. And after the police leave, Bienvenu tells Valjean to use the silver to become an honest man. These were Hugo's words. Forget not, never forget, that you have promised me to use this silver to become an honest man. Jean Valjean, my brother, you no longer belong to evil, but to good. It's your soul that I'm buying for you. I withdraw it from dark thoughts and from the spirit of perdition, and I give it to God. In the musical, the point is made even more powerfully. But remember this, my brother. See in this some higher plan. You must use this precious silver to become an honest man. By the witness of the martyrs, by the passion in the blood, God has raised you out of darkness. I have bought your soul for God. Now, what's most amazing about this is Victor Hugo was anti-clerical. Very anti-clerical. He had a strong anger against the church. He could have easily based the bishop on a heartless ecclesiocrat, on one who had lived a double life, or in some other way was negative or even mediocre. His son was trying to persuade him to make the instrument of conversion a doctor or a professor or somebody other than a cleric. But Hugo kept the bishop because he knew of the bishop in his lifetime. And he wanted to show through manifesting this bishop's charity the standard to which his readers ought to hold their own bishops. He thought that most bishops would fall short, and the lack of charity in the episcopate would be sufficient justification for people to recognize that the gospel really didn't have the power to change us to become like Christ. Because if it couldn't change the leaders of the church to resemble the Lord, to be men of God, then how could it really change them? I think it's a challenge held up in every age for us to become, for the sake of the Lord's name, Father Bienvenu, Bishop Caritas, Archbishop Misericordia. The documents of the church focus very much on the centrality of charity in the life and ministry of bishops. I'll focus on what St. John Paul II said in Pastoris Gregis. He writes extensively about it throughout the entire document. Christ is the primordial icon of the Father and the manifestation of his merciful presence among men and women, he says. And the bishop's three functions of teaching, sanctifying, and governing the people of God are to be carried out in imitation of the charity of the Good Shepherd. With charity, knowledge of the flock, concern for all, mercy toward the poor, the stranger and those in need, a willingness to seek out the lost sheep and to bring them back to the one sheepfold. Bishops are supposed to be images of this primordial icon of the Father's heart. He mentions that St. Augustine defines the entire episcopal ministry as an amoris officium, an office of love. And this gives us the certainty, he says, that the pastoral charity of Jesus Christ will never be lacking in the church. Later he says, charity is in a sense the heart of the ministry of the bishop, who's drawn into a dynamic pastoral pro-existence, whereby he's impelled to live like Christ the Good Shepherd for the Father and for others in the daily gift of self. The bishop just doesn't have an existence. The bishop has a pro existentia, he says, that he's a man for God and for others. He's been ordained for this gift of self. John Paul II goes on and says, unless the episcopal office is based on a witness of the holiness manifested in pastoral charity, humility, simplicity of life, it ends up being reduced to a solely functional role, and tragically it loses its credibility before the clergy and the faithful. He says the spiritual growth in a bishop is growth in charity. He says the spiritual journey of the bishop coincides with that of pastoral charity, which must rightly be considered the soul of his apostolate. Here again, it's not a matter of an existentia, but of a pro-existentia. That is to say, of a way of living inspired by the supreme model of Christ the Lord, and which is spent totally in worship of the Father and in service of neighbor. One of the characteristic forms of charity in the church is the compassion of the bishop, he says, who, like Christ, our high priest, is able to sympathize with human weakness because he himself is tempted in every respect, yet without sinning. This compassion is always linked to the responsibility that the bishop is accepted before God in the church. It's in this way that he fulfills the promises and carries out the commitments made on the day of his episcopal ordination. when he freely assented to the church's charge to care for the holy people of God as a devoted father and to guide them in the way of salvation, to be always welcoming and merciful in the name of the Lord to the poor, the sick, and those in need and comfort and help, like a good shepherd to go out in search of the sheep who stray in order to bring them back to the fold of Christ. And the final quotation, the bishop of the third millennium is called to do what was done by so many saintly bishops throughout history, up to our own time, like St. Basil, who even built at the gates of Caesarea a large hospice for those in need, a true citadel of charity, which was called after him the Basiliad. This clearly demonstrates that the charity of works ensures in unmistakable efficacy to the charity of words. I want to repeat that because it's beautiful and I think it's lapidary. The charity of works ensures an unmistakable efficacy to the charity of words. For the proclamation of the gospel to have credibility, it's going to be led by the gospel in body language. That's the beachhead. Let's take up the example of some of these bishops to whom St. John Paul II referred. First one is St. Nicholas. We know his story, born in the town of Patara in the Roman province of Asia, now in southern Turkey. Grew up in the faith, was formed in a good Christian home. After his parents both died when he was young, he looked to sow his life for the gospel. Before he would enter training to become a priest, and then later would become the Bishop of Myra, modern-day Demre, Turkey, he would already be giving what he had for others. That's the famous story of his help for the poor family in Patara when he was still a layman. The culture of the time looked at women as burdens of the men who were responsible for them. In order for a girl to marry, the father had to provide her with a dowry so that her new husband would be able to pay for her upkeep, at least for some period of time. Families without money for a dowry often couldn't get their daughters hitched. One poor father didn't know what to do for his three girls, for whom there was a danger. If he were to die or become incapable of work, they would be driven or drawn into prostitution for survival. Nicholas heard of the family situation, and one night threw a bag of gold coins through the family's open window, enough for the dowry of the oldest daughter, who was soon married. A short time later, he threw in another bag, sufficient for the dowry of the middle daughter, who likewise was married. Months later, Nicholas tossed a third bag to help marry the third daughter of the father, who was waiting this time to find out who was his anonymous benefactor. The generosity of St. Nicholas is continued, we know, through the generosity of Santa Claus every Christmas. When we, like St. Nicholas, pay forward the generosity we have received from God, it's unsurprising that someone like St. Nicholas, who had compassion on that poor family, sacrifices inheritance to help them, would likewise sow his entire life for Christ and his gospel, becoming a laborer in his vineyard and continuing the Lord's work of proclamation, teaching, and healing. The Lord is hoping that we will be touched in the same way as Nicholas, from his encounter with Christ, so that we too will engage with Christ in that dynamism of the continuance of the Lord's compassionate work. Next bishop I'd like to focus on is St. Landry. Now, you may not know that there's a St. Landry. There are actually four St. Landrys. This is the most famous of them all, Bishop of Paris, who died in 661, whose feast day is June 10th, if you'd ever like to mark it. If you go to the Diocese of Lafayette, Louisiana, in the main city there of Opelousas, there's a church dedicated to St. Landry. Just a little funny story. I celebrated my 10th Mass there because my classmate was being ordained in the Archdiocese of New Orleans, and so I got a car and I drove on up and met some seminarians from Lafayette. And I picked up some of the bulletins of St. Landry Parish, and I brought them home to my dad. My mom is the one who's the Legion of Mary Presidia president knocking on doors. My dad was never one much to go on out. But as soon as I armed him with St. Landry bulletins, you'd never believe how many people my dad met describing the good work being done in this parish in Opelousas. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, Bishop in the 650s died in 661 in Paris. There's a chapel dedicated to Notre Dame, and his relics were in the beautiful Saint-Germain-l'Auxerrois across from the Louvre. But when there was a famine in Paris, he sold all his personal property and much of what the church had to care for the poor during that time. And because there were no hospitals to speak of at the time, he built the first, which he dedicated to Saint Christopher. Because so many of the sick were pilgrims who had no family to care for them. Eventually, this hospital grew to become the huge institution called today Hôtel Dieu, God's Hotel, where he sought to treat patients like they were Christ, saying to him, "I was ill and you cared for me." His longing to see Christ in prayer allowed him to see Christ far more easily in his image, even when that image was sick, coughing, disfigured, and otherwise in need. The last figure is St. Charles Borromeo. St. Charles distinguished himself during the famine of 1571 by feeding 3,000 people a day from his own table. Think about that. And after the devastating plague of 1576, where he assured the people he wouldn't leave, challenged his priests not to abandon their flock, urging them to prefer a holy death to a late one. His whole life was symbolized by that charity when the need was greatest. He wasn't going to run away like a mercenary, but as a good shepherd, he was going to care in that moment. Let's parse a little bit this resolution. Do you resolve to be welcoming? We know that there are two ways to welcome. The first is when people actually come, we don't reject them, but embrace them. There's a second way to welcome. It's to go out to meet them. Both are expressions of mercy, but I think we can all see that one is superior. Pope Francis went to Lampedusa. Could have just spoken about it as he had, but he went. He went to Lesbos. You know, in Luke 15, we see the figure of the father of the prodigal son, not waiting for the son to make his whole journey back to the house to give his rehearsed speech. But as soon as he sees him, he runs out to welcome him in an icon, I believe, of the way priests and bishops should always welcome. We need to create a culture of welcoming, leading by example. Second is merciful, which is literally a heart for the poor, misericordia. A heart for the poor, for the miserable. The evangelists use this term for Jesus' mercy, splankna, splanknitsomai, which literally means his bowels were bursting. He was sick to his stomach. And it's because of that that he acted. We see how there were five expressions or five verbs that came after the splanknitsomai. Jesus, out of mercy, fed the multitudes, healed so many, forgave, taught. When he saw the crowds who were like sheep without a shepherd, his heart was moved with pity for them, Shpagnitsamai, and he began to teach them many things. And fifth, with his heart filled with mercy, he called his followers to pray for laborers, and then as they were praying, he called them in response to that prayer. These are all means of the church's mercy at every period that we feed so many food pantries, so many St. Vincent de Paul conferences. We heal so many hospitals. We forgive the confessionals. We teach with so many schools. And we pray and we continue to call others to share in this urgent need. The resolution focuses on the poor. Jesus came, as we know, to preach the gospel to the poor. The church calls us to preach through our own poverty as well, to help lift people out of the poverty. The church has been acting on the sustainable development goals for centuries, actually carrying that out, which is one of the reasons for our great credibility at the international level. Pope Francis, in Evangelii Gaudium, called the poor a theological category. What does that mean? that God speaks to us not just about the poor, but that the poor reveal God. At this time in which charity is the beachhead of the new evangelization, in which the need is growing, 65 million refugees in the world, can we up our game? Strangers, it specifies. You know, when I was a newspaper editor, the editorials that I would be most criticized for would be anything that I would say with regard to immigration. That many of our Catholic people, we have to admit it candidly, don't see Christ in their neighbor. And what I would always say in the immigration debate is, if you would say to Christ, show me your color card, or if you would even say to one of your blood brothers and sisters, get out of my country, then you've got credibility to say it to somebody else. But if you wouldn't say it to somebody you really care about, remember who's showing up. Immigrants and refugees. You know, I wonder if we in the United States could do something like the Pope has invited the churches in Europe to do, which is to ask every parish to take in one of these families. All those in need is the last. You can obviously specify the sick and the dying. Why does the Lord allow sickness? St. John Paul II said in Salvifici Dolores, to unleash love, to force us to become good Samaritans. You can think about the mentally ill and the depressed, the addicts, the unemployed, the wounded, especially those wounded in the church, the spiritually and famished. They should all have precedence and our priorities. I want to finish with a thought from Rome. And when I would give tours of the upstairs basilica, we would see all the various papal tombs, and in the papal tombs there would always be two virtues that the Pope himself wanted to be remembered for, or that the cardinals who were building his tomb after his demise remembered him for. So some of the tombs have a flaming sword with a toe stomping out England to show the virtue of divine justice. Others, an open book with eyes looking heavenward to show contemplation. The vigilance looking underneath surfaces. Various virtues. But I was always impressed with one of the ones Bernini put on the tomb of Alexander VII that nobody can identify today. You've got a woman with three babies, and it asks them, what do you think this virtue symbolizes? And it'd say patience. It's not a whole long litany of guesses, but it's curious today that almost no one, including the women, would come up that is the virtue to symbolize love. Mother with her children. We've lost it in our culture. But Alexander VII wished to be remembered for his charity. If we had a chance to design our own tomb and it were to have images of the virtues, which virtues would we want to be remembered for? I remember early in my priesthood, soon after I had become a pastor, I was wondering if I were to be taken that retreat, what I would be remembered for. And the great fear of my life is that my parishioners would say, he was really wicked smart. It changed me, because I would hope that there'd be a little bit of a woman with three children that I would be known for, because otherwise my priesthood would be wasted. What would we want? St. John Vianney saw all that God had given him as a depository placed in his hands, and with his poche à navette, as he called it, his shuttle pocket, whatever he got in from the Lord, he tried to dispense. And he found that the more he gave out, the more that the Lord gave him 100-fold even in this life. How many blessings we have received. How awesome would it be if we were just as generous giving outwardly. As we come to the altar of God, we remember that command to which we've been faithful all the days since our priestly ordination. Do this in memory of me. Which is not just a command to celebrate the sacred synaxis each day, but it's to model our whole life on the self-giving love of the Lord, to become a commentary on the words of consecration. So we come prepared to receive that gift and be transformed into the giver more and more. Let us ask him for the grace that when he asks us today to resolve for the sake of my name to be welcoming and merciful to the poor, strangers, and to all those in need, we will be as generous to them as he has been to us. Praise be Jesus Christ.